from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nick Kristof is known for columns in the New York Times that bring a human face to big world problems. Human rights, poverty, global health, more. With those columns, he unabashedly tries to raise awareness, rally support, action. Now, with his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, he's going straight to that point. You can change the world, they write, and here's how. This hour on Point, Nick Kristof on changing the world. Later this hour, we will talk about the life and legacy of fabled Washington Post editor Ben Bradlee, who died Tuesday at age 93. Here's just a little bit of Ben Bradlee, that distinctive voice, that distinctive view. 2006 with Jim Lehrer on PBS NewsHour.
It changes your life, the pursuit of truth. And it, at least if you know that you have tried to find the truth and gone past the first apparent truth towards the real truth, it's very exciting, I find.
We'll dive back in on Ben Bradlee with Nick Kristof and NPR's David Folkenflik. With me now from New York is Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. His new book, written with his wife and longtime reporter, editor Cheryl Wu Dunn, is A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Kristof, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
You've written on so many fronts about so many things, but this time it's a kind of a direct appeal. You're teaching, I guess, by multiple example here. What are you hoping to provoke, to make happen with this book?
Well, after our last joint book, Half the Sky, people kept approaching us and asking, so what can I do? What do I do? And, you know, it really felt to us as if there's so many people who would like to make a difference, would like to have an impact. Maybe it's they want to model behavior for their kids, or maybe they want to find a little more purpose or meaning in life, or maybe they just want to, you know, make things a little better. And yet they're disillusioned. The problem seems so vast that they wonder whether one person can actually have any impact. They are concerned about corruption or inefficiency. And so that leads them to kind of tune out. And indeed, we think the concerns are perfectly valid. There are real issues with corruption and inefficiency. But at the end of the day, we also think that now, much more than 10 or 20 years ago, we really understand the kinds of things that are more likely to have an impact, both at home and abroad. There's much better evidence of what works, and that if people want to go about having an impact on the causes they care about, they truly can.
There's sort of a hard sell in here. There's a soft sell. There's a factual sell. Paul Collier wrote it up in the New York Times and said that only scoundrels and saints can read this book safely. Everyone else will find it upsetting and uplifting in equal measure, as he did. He said, if you want to carry on with your life just as it is, best to give this one a miss. I guess that's your point. You're trying to put stories down here that say, given how the world can be changed by you, dear reader, why, and given how fulfilling that can be, the case you make, why not go do it?
That's right. And, you know, we think that there's pretty good evidence that, in fact, we are hardwired to some extent to want to do that. We are pro-social organisms, and individuals who volunteer or engage with others have better health, live longer. It's satisfying. And yet we also have this remarkable ability to kind of tune out, to be wary of it. We have these impulses at cross purposes.
What's the change?
So we're trying to give a little bit of a nudge to the altruistic side.
I call it more than a little nudge. It's a big fat one here. How do you describe the sort of terrain of change that you're hoping people to encourage to work on? People have all different notions of what change is even needed.
Sure. Well, for Cheryl and me, the transcendent challenge is to create opportunity. And that is obviously related to inequality. I sometimes wonder if those of us who are a little more liberal shouldn't maybe use the word inequality a little bit less. I wonder if that sometimes scares off conservatives who are thinking about inequality of outcomes, and whether we shouldn't more use the word opportunity, which maybe is a way of framing it that is more broad. You know, that I mean, there are just so many kids at home and abroad who don't have equal chance at the escalator of life, whether it's because of gender or poverty or lack of access to education. and their ways of addressing that, I mean, both abroad and at home. So our motto is, talent is universal, but opportunity is not, and that there are ways of not perfectly resolving that, but certainly spreading the opportunity more broadly.
That is such a big deal to me as somebody who grew up fairly far from the silver spoon, but at a time when the country seemed more oriented toward wider opportunity. If I look back on my own life, and I think you've got elements of this as well, Nick, if that hadn't been there, that sense that there are ramps out that you can, there are ladders and rungs that you might reach, young person, without that, it's hard to picture what my relationship to society would have been. My understanding of my own country would have been fundamentally different.
That's absolutely true. And indeed, historically, the U.S. has done a pretty good job of providing opportunity by global standards. And in part, that was because we pioneered mass education. Europe mm-hmm. pioneered great elite education for small numbers of people. And the U.S. Really led the way in mass literacy, then led the way in high schools, and then led the way in fairly broad tertiary education. And since 1970, we've frozen, and other countries have surpassed us in high school graduation rates, in college attendance, and in preschool, which to me is just the basis of opportunity, that these early childhood interventions, and the U.S. is staggeringly behind other countries in access to that early childhood education. And, you know, so sometimes we measure inequality by metrics like family income or family wealth, and it's so much more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. I sometimes wonder if the better metrics aren't things like how many children's books there are in a house, or how often a kid is taken to a library, or how often a child is read to. And these are complicated things to measure and to address. They involve parenting gaps as well as equality gaps. But the evidence is, again, that they can be addressed. There are ways to help. There are ways to reach out and truly make a difference.
When you set out to lure people in to that undertaking, that enterprise of trying to make a difference here, Paul Collier writes again, he says that you kind of treat the reader with a presumption that that reader is a calculating egoist. They're going to want strokes for what they do or some payback for what they do. It may be self-centered, but you make the case that even if that's where one begins, this is a worthy enterprise. Let's hear some of that.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, we've always sort of heard, you know, the biblical adage that it is more blessed to give than to receive.
Of course.
And it turns out that there's actually some real evidence for that. The first evidence for that came from correlations that people who were more engaged in public service or in giving lived longer, that they have better health markers, and that they report greater happiness. And indeed, your way in Boston, there was one famous study that began in the 1930s with a young cohort of more than 200 Harvard students and followed them, regularly looked at their lives, and it found that for those young people over the course of their lives, that engaging in, you know, trying to make a difference in the world correlated more to life expectancy than their cholesterol levels did. And then there have been plenty of other studies. One found that for seniors that joining a religious organization reduced mortality risk by 29%. Exercising several times a day reduced mortality risk by several times a week reduced mortality by 30%. And volunteering for a good cause reduced mortality by 44%. And then Cheryl and we supplemented this. Now we can look in the brain, and there are these pleasure centers in the brain, like the nucleus accumbens. And we participated in a study where those are examined as one is getting money and also as one is giving. And they light up when you give. This is a really primal part of the brain associated with pleasures like eating good food or flirting or sex. And giving is just as primal a pleasure. For about half of Americans, they seem to derive as much pleasure from giving as they do from getting.
So you're kind of arguing that the Gucci bag is not going to bring you ultimately, even if you're self-centered, egoist, whatever it may be, it's not going to give you the same psychic or even sort of even longevity payoff as going out and doing something giving-oriented.
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of studies on kind of the Gucci bag effect, if you will, or the winning of the lottery effect. And it turns out that when you buy something cool that you you know, that you want, that Gucci bag or whatever, that there's an initial rush of happiness. And, you know, at first you're thrilled. Your self-reported happiness goes up. You can see this in brain scans. And then it wears off remarkably quickly. You just get used to it. So that if you're trying to spend money effectively to boost your own happiness, you're much better off doing that to buy experiences, which may seem ephemeral but actually live on in your mind. So, you know, that exotic vacation or whatever. And also to spend it helping people. There was, one study in which people randomly handed out $20 bills in Harvard Square to people and randomly assigned them either to spend it on themselves or on other people. And everybody thought that they would get more pleasure if they spent it on themselves. And then when there was a follow-up call that evening, it found that overwhelmingly the people were happier if they had been assigned to the group to give it to others.
There's the personal payoff side. We want to go to the effectiveness side. There's a lot of jaundiced kind of perspective out there, a lot of cynicism about whether the big changes can actually be made. Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Wudun say yes, they can in their new book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winning columnist, globetrotter, moral thinker, reporter, Nicholas Kristof. He says, you can change the world. New book out with his wife Cheryl Wudun is A Path Appears. Nick, we need some examples here. James writes to us online. He says, I'll give this guy a chance, but I'll say at the outset, it's much easier to write about changing the world than it is to actually change the world. And then it's sort of a hashtag aside. The guy from the New York Times who goes to movie premieres going to tell us regular folk how we can change the world. He wants the proof points, Nick. Lay some out for us.
Sure. Well, I mean, and he's right that helping people is harder than it looks. And anybody who has traveled abroad has seen plenty of well-meant projects that made a lot of sense sitting around a conference room in New York.
A lot of white jeeps, but what are they doing?
Yeah, and this is a real problem, and you know, it's a real issue. But anybody who has traveled abroad, you know, or around the home, has also seen efforts that have had a transformative impact. And so, you know, one of the stories we follow in A Path Appears involves clubfoot, which is a congenital deformity that happens about one child in 1,000. In the U.S., we never see people with clubfoot because it's handled at birth. And in fact, it was only when we were writing the book that it turned out that my mom had clubfoot, and I had no idea.
Wow.
I mean, she's very energetic, and there was a young woman who had actually been an athlete in college in California, named Shoshana Klein, who had sent a check to an organization that deals with clubfoot. And we followed the money to a hospital in Niger in West Africa. And that check was enough to repair the clubfoot on a little girl named Rashida, who – and in this village in the past, kids with clubfoot had not been able to go to school, not been able to walk, not been able to marry. They became beggars in the street. I mean, it just – as much of a loss of opportunity and human dignity as you can imagine. And now Rashida will have her life is just transformed because of Shoshana's gift. And so that is the kind of thing that one really can see. And I've seen that over and over. Blindness used to be the thing that maybe distressed me the most in the developing world, because there were so many people, middle age, going blind from cataracts, from river blindness, from trachoma. And we saw a $40 operation through Helen Keller International from just a nurse, not even a doctor. It took 20 minutes and ended this woman's blindness that she'd suffered for years. Incredibly painful trochiasis of the consequence of trachoma. And when you see things like that, I mean, it's A, a reminder that one can truly have an impact, and B, it's not depressing. It's incredibly uplifting.
Just those two examples, and there are more, and we'll hear more, but to give us a sense of your definition of changing the world. I mean, this is not necessarily changing the systems. You're
right.
Very happy to see it go to relieve personal misery and pain, and that counts.
That's right. I mean, there's a counter argument that, look, these are just drops in the bucket. You know, there are millions of people who are blind or have club foot, and these little gifts here or there aren't going to solve that global problem. And, you know, look, that's right. And I think we do need to be pushing for broader global systemic solutions. And one of the things we talk a lot about in the mm-hmm. book is advocacy and how to bring about that change. But in the meantime, you know, there are these girls like Rashida. And if we can, with modest, reallocation of resources, have a transformative impact on her life, then, boy, we should do so. I think I'm also maybe a – one of the reasons why Drops in the Bucket appeal to me is that my dad was a refugee in World War II from Romania. Mm-hmm. And he was sponsored by a family in Portland, Oregon that took a risk on him. They'd never met him, and they sponsored his way to come to the U.S. It didn't solve the global refugee problem. It didn't make a dent in it. But for my dad, that drop in the bucket was utterly transformative, and I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for that drop in the bucket.
It means the world. Talk about changing the world. There's a world changed. Add them up, and it's a lot. Nick Kristof's new book is A Path Appears. Nicholas Kristof, lots of callers for you. Walterboro, South Carolina. Wynn is calling. Hi, Wynn. You're on the air with Nick Kristof.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think?
Hello?
Yes, you're on. What do you think?
Yes, I respect Mr. Kristof and I admire what he desires, but I think sometimes we don't keep track of the practicalities involved in offering our help. If you looked at the profile of individuals who can do that, oftentimes they're either very...
Oh, you're breaking up, but I caught just enough. Nick Wynn is saying the profile of people who are going out and doing this, it's rich kids, it's rich people, people with means at their back. Without those... How, practically speaking, how are you supposed to join the Kristof parade here?
Sure. Well, let me disentangle two things. One is the giving and the other the kind of the overseas service trips. On the giving side, one of the things that is kind of shocking is that the wealthiest 20% of Americans actually donate less as a percentage of income than the poorest 20% of Americans. And I think that that is not because the wealthiest are less good people or less empathetic or less compassionate. I think it's that if you're wealthy in America, you essentially manage to insulate yourself from need. You live in a nice neighborhood. You don't encounter people who are in need. But if you're poor in America, every day you encounter people who are poorer than you. And so you respond.
Because you feel it, because it's more visceral to you.
Exactly. This seems very real and tangible to you because it's that neighbor who needs money to get a tooth pulled to deal with a toothache or whatever it may be.
But there's Wynn. She's not loaded. It sounds as though she'd like to, get on this bandwagon, but she feels like, well, how am I supposed to do that? Maybe I'm, look at my wage. Look at what I'm trying to do just to get along.
Yeah. Quite apart from the check writing mm-hmm. issue, then there are two avenues that cost essentially nothing, and one is volunteering. And there's a huge need for mentoring kids in particular, and in particular for men to mentor boys. There's a huge waiting list for boys who need mentoring, but also. Reading, and there's a great program called Experience Corps that we write about that takes people to tutor reading in schools, help kids in the library, that kind of thing. And then there's advocacy. They're just great organizations like Results.org or like the One Campaign, where we can use our voice to advocate on behalf of those who tend not to have a voice.
Doesn't require wealth to do that, though. The wealth can certainly supercharge it, and does.
Right. I wondered if Wynn was talking in part about these kind of service trips abroad, which have indeed become kind of a upper middle class thing for young people, where they spend a summer off, building a clinic or whatever it may be, and I think there is indeed some reasons for a certain amount of skepticism about that. I remember hearing about I think it was a clinic in Mexico that got painted 8 times over the course of one summer by troops of high school kids showing their
paying
showing
handsomely
their compassion.
To do it. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And, at the end of the day, the developing world, what it has is labor. And so efforts that send a bunch of American kids abroad to provide labor, I'm not sure how much that adds.
I still admire the impulse, but yes, you've got to watch out for the bottom line. How much? What's the net accomplishment?
That's right. But often, I mean, one thing that any American kid has that is in need is fluent English. And so tutoring people in English is something that is genuinely valuable. And I think that these trips also create a constituency for international issues, for international understanding that we do need in the U.S. And so whether or not it helps, you know, those kids at that clinic or that school or whatever it may be, I think it does help America that we have more people who have spent time in a village somewhere and just have – for whom these issues are a little more real.
Nick Kristoff says, change the world, one effort at a time, and better world, better you. John in Brooklyn, New York. John, you're on the air with Nick.
Oh, yes, hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
And I also want to say that I'm very proud to be a regular person.
me too.
That, about four years ago, my wife and I decided to open up a little wedding business. Me as a minister conducting them and my wife coordinating ceremonies. But we also, you know, ran into, you know, something that we really felt that we could have a positive and profound effect on people by offering them relationship counseling. A lot of times what we felt as we were talking to couples that were about to make this adventurous journey through life together, they didn't seem to be in the right place. And not that we judge people, but in the state of affairs in society today, there are so many marriages that end abruptly, you know, through anger and discontent. And what we felt was that we can contribute to the world in some way where we could, you know, help people go through the course of their lives and with a greater understanding of one another.
So you started with a wedding business and you went on to what, couples counseling?
That is correct. And we do that for absolutely free. We really feel led to really, really help people through a period of their lives where if it is just a period of their lives, and often it turns out to be just that, where they're just going through rough personal patches,
yeah,
that we help people to draw together so that they could keep not only their relationships alive, but as you know today, many people get married after they've created families.
Yeah, still be there as parents for their kids. Which is more gratifying, John, then, the wedding business side, ka-ching, or the counseling side?
Absolutely the counseling side. I mean, we love doing weddings. This is, you know, my wife and I's calling, frankly. But there's no greater reward than it is to have a positive effect on people this way when they just are lost.
John, we've got it, and I appreciate your call from Brooklyn. Does that make your screen for changing the world, Nick?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, one of the things that I think we're learning from just a sea of data now is that one thing conservatives really got right was the importance of stable families for outcomes of kids. And we now have just a lot of evidence that boys in particular have better outcomes when they have access to a dad or somebody at home like that. But conversely, one of the things that I think conservatives got profoundly wrong that is related to it is mass incarceration, which led to a lot of those dads being away and led to more breakups of these families. But there's mixed data. There have been some efforts at kind of providing conflict resolution counseling to couples to see if that will create more stable families, keep them together. So far, they have not been hugely successful, partly I think because it's a fairly expensive process and so you know, but maybe this gentleman has a knack, and so boy, more power to him, because I think that this issue of stable families is one that increasingly we're recognizing really is important, not just to the husband and wife, but to the kids.
We're talking about changing the world, one act, maybe one act of counseling, you name it, at a time with Nicholas Kristoff. His new book is A Path Appears. Aaron in Detroit. Thanks for calling, Aaron. You're on. What do you see?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
And it's admirable, the thought of fixing us as a species, so to speak. I wanted to make this comment, though.
Yes.
There's very few things that we as a species or as a society do perfectly, and other than reproduce, to discriminate against one another is what we do almost perfectly. We would discriminate against each other for any reason. And one of the most destructive and obvious things that we discriminate is through race, right?
Yes.
And I've always contemplated, how can something so obviously counterproductive and obviously illogical last for so long? And in order for that to happen in an intelligent society, it has to be ignored, or for whatever reason, it has to make people uncomfortable to acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't acknowledge something, you can't work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so sensitive to us, and it's so embarrassing to us because we have evolved in such other ways, and technologically and in other ways in our society. It's almost impossible for us to admit that we still do those type of things so thoroughly, to the point where it's entrenched in everything. And like in America, everything in America is based on race.
Aaron, let me take it to Nick Kristoff while I have time before the break. Nick, there's a man in Detroit with a very supple understanding of a very big issue. You've written about it plenty, What Whites Just Don't Get,
yeah.
You, three parts on that. But in this context of going out, helping, doing, did you find examples of people who could change things on that front, the race front?
Yeah, and you know, we tend intuitively on issues of race to think about advocacy, to deal with criminal justice system in the ways that are unfair, profoundly unfair to African Americans. For example, blacks and whites use drugs at apparently the same rate, and yet African Americans are arrested for drug offenses at three times the rate of whites. So we tend to lean toward advocacy, and that's great. But think also of some of these early childhood interventions. If I try to think how we can create more opportunity for some African-American kids, then one of the huge needs is supporting kids early. And, you know, we tend not to do that. White suburban kids in the middle class get a great education. And an African-American kid in the inner city gets a third-rate school, and the police are not as energetic in dealing with gangs and other problems in that area. You know, we can there are things we can do to try to change the system, but there are also things we can do on an individual basis through tutoring, mentoring, that will really make a difference.
All kinds of people picking up that message. Nick Kristoff reporting with Cheryl Wudunn on many of them in his new book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. Alicia Keys, one of those he's written about not so long ago in his column, with her We Are Here movement, looking to channel music and her fans to social justice causes, criminal justice reform, gay rights, global girls education. Nick Kristoff has written about issues all over the world, brings it back now to, okay, what are we going to do about those issues? He joins us today from New York. You can join us. Are you one of these people getting out there, doing it? Is it working? What's your question for Nick Kristoff? What's the place, the issue, the challenge you want to hear Nick Kristoff take on? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. And we'll talk with Nick Kristoff and David Folkenflik of NPR before this hour is over about the great editor, now passed, Ben Bradley. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, globetrotter, moral thinker, reporter Nicholas Kristoff, with his wife Cheryl Wudunn. He's written a book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. It's all about changing the world. And we will be joined by David Folkenflik in a moment, Nick and David, to talk about the big editor of The Washington Post, Watergate, and all the rest, Ben Bradley. Nick, callers for you, just a mile long here. Mike in Madison, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Nick Kristoff. What's your story, Mike?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm someone who actually has managed to make a career out of my passion. I have a degree in physics. I used to be a rocket scientist. I used to develop advanced sensors for the space shuttle engines and also work on classified military projects.
Okay.
About 17 years ago, though, I discovered I really loved working with kids, and managed to turn that into something of a career. I'm now run a physics outreach program in Madison, and we reach about 36,000 people a year.
Wow! From missiles to big outreach. And what do you outreach with? What are you doing with them?
We do these really amazing shows. I actually go out to schools and other community organizations, and I put on these hour-long shows that gets kids excited about science and physics, and has them empowers them into getting that they're already physicists and that they're already using physics in everything that they do.
Are you here to tell us then, Mike, that it's great? You know, it's all roses out there, or what's your experience after 17 years?
It's really challenging. Specifically, that our program is the funding that we do get is 90% out of federal grant money, and that money has been cut off. So I have about 90% of my budget that I need to replace very shortly. So it can be very, very challenging, and it's hard work without doing fundraising on top of that. But it's like I want people to get. I do it. I'm not making a ton of money at this. I could be making a lot more money in something else, but I love what I do, and I get to see the impact. And in many cases, I actually don't get to, but I believe that these kids, if they get excited about science young, they could carry on and they could create whole careers for themselves, and who knows, maybe the next Einstein will come out of
that. That would be great. Mike, stand by. Nick Kristof, here's a pilgrim on your path, and it's great, but it's also a little wearying 17 years in and not easy.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's an uphill struggle. And one of the challenges in the nonprofit sector is that it is there's this multiplicity of tiny organizations that tend not to scale up. And there's been this, you know, on the one hand, this wonderful move towards social entrepreneurship that I find really heartening. On the other hand, the fact that there are millions and millions of small organizations makes it hard to scale. There's no M&A in the nonprofit sector, and that's a real challenge for the whole sector. And Mike, I'm curious: is your outreach program, is this in, you know, not just the great kind of middle class schools in Madison, but also to some of the, you know, the broken schools or the tougher schools where maybe the kids need it even more?
What do you say, Mike? Oh, Mike! Mike's back at work. Oh. Maybe
okay.
I can't get to Mike. One more right here, Teresa in Cheshire, Connecticut. Teresa, you're on with Nick Kristof.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
And I have to say, I love Half the Sky, and I love your work. I volunteer for a post.
You like A Path Appears even more.
There you go.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to it. I volunteer for Postpartum Support International. We help women and their families who are dealing with perinatal mood disorders, so during pregnancy and after pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing this for a long time, both as the legal resources coordinator for the organization and also as a state coordinator here in Connecticut. And for a long time, I've been doing talks and trying to encourage training and awareness and helping women one-on-one. And I know that helping people one-on-one and giving talks can feel like it's insufficient and can feel frustrating, particularly when you can't find good resources. But I've also had a bigger picture about wanting to have much more robust resources here in Connecticut and wanting the Postpartum Support International to offer a lot more for women who've had postpartum psychosis. And now I am getting to see both of those things happen. Postpartum Support International is starting to have a broad range, offering a lot of things, legal training, professional training, resources on the website for women with postpartum psychosis and their families. And our state now has an alliance to build resources in our state.
So you're seeing the one-to-one grow into a bigger impact, Teresa.
Well, seeing the one-on-one continue and the sort of continuing to plod away on the on the system-wide thing finally coming to fruition. Because I think sometimes systems change can seem so big and so impossible, we don't even want to start down that road because it seems so impossible and you do so much. But for me, it's just amazing what I'm seeing happen now.
That's great that the one-on-one goes there. Nick?
And Teresa, I mean, I'm sure you know this and see this, but one of the great benefits of treating those women for postpartum depression is not only the impact on them, but on their kids. And there's growing evidence now that there are an awful lot of low-income moms around the country who are suffering from clinical depression. And, you know, the upshot is that it's a lot harder to be a great mom if you are suffering from that clinical depression and you're not getting help. One study found that half of low-income moms were suffering from clinical depression. And, you know, if we're learning now how important it is for parents to speak to a child and hug that child and interact with that child a great deal in the first couple of years of life. And boy, if you know, if that mom is suffering from depression, that's an uphill struggle.
Teresa, you
so
go.
So bravo to you.
Yes. Nick, I want to go to the scale issue and how deep, how wide, how real the change. Not everybody listening, at least to what we've presented here, fully on board. Here's Dana, who writes to us on Facebook, says, Mr. Kristoff seems to be persuaded by the enlightened self-interest school, which serves the corporate agenda. Charity and taking a kid to the library are fine, but fail to get to the root of badly needed social change and equality. I'm disappointed that he's considered by On Point to be a serious source of changing the world. There's that big system change desire. We had Russell Brand on last week, you know, the British comic who's now got a book out, Revolution. He's saying, hey, I don't even want to talk about all this celebrity philanthropy. We've got to go out and change things root and branch. You know, revolution itself is where he's pushing. Maybe Dana would go that way. How do you respond? Yeah. Come on, system,
well,
big.
You know, I think one needs to change things at both ends. And it is true that, you know, we wouldn't think of building an interstate highway system by having individuals go out with shovels and, you know, or whole bake sales to finance it. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, we shouldn't try to build a childhood education system in America with bake sales and individual efforts. But the truth is that, you know, right now we don't have that system, and kids don't have mentors, and they're not getting support, and they're not, and moms aren't getting that postpartum counseling. And so, in the absence of that, boy, you know, let's not let these kids fall through the cracks. Let's do what we can, and whether that is through writing checks or volunteering or advocacy, let's not sort of hold out for some symbolic gain in the future, and let these kids suffer in the meantime.
Well, we'll see if Dana takes that as a full answer. I guess it's the ratio in some ways between advocacy and personal change, small scale. And I wonder how you look at that. You know, how political are you encouraging people to be here versus direct action, help the one in pain?
You know, I mean, both. And but, for example, private donations have been enormously important to higher education and to private schools. But, you know, business schools benefit tremendously from private donations. On the other hand, business schools probably don't need those donations quite so much. And if people were willing to endow wings of nursery schools in troubled neighborhoods, you know, boy, that would actually have a real impact on equality in America, on opportunity in America. And so I don't think we should diss the opportunity to have private philanthropy and private volunteering have an impact. But do we need broader systemic solutions? Absolutely.
Nick Kristoff is author with Cheryl Wu Dunn of A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, all about changing the world. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick, it's a treat to have you, and I want to take advantage of that for a moment to talk about Ben Bradlee, who died yesterday after so many fabled years at the helm of the Washington Post in the heart of his career. He led the Post for 26 years. He was at the helm there for landmark moments in American journalism, Watergate, Pentagon Papers. He made those moments happen in many ways, transformed the Washington Post, in many ways journalism itself. Last year, awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He died Tuesday at 93, kind of, for at least for a baby boom generation, a sort of folk hero. Here's a little bit from the dramatized version of the Washington Post covering Watergate, 1976 movie, All the President's Men. Here was Jason Robards' take on playing Ben Bradlee, talking with reporters Woodward and Bernstein.
We're under a lot of pressure, you know, and you put us there. Nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment of the Constitution, freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country.
Nothing except that. Nick Kristoff, I want to dive in on Ben Bradley for a second. And joining us to help do that is David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. David, thanks very much for being with us today.
Great to join you.
Nick, you were an intern early on at the Washington Post. Was it the Bradley era? Did you feel the famed aura, the famed charisma?
Oh, boy. I mean, Jason Robards was nothing on charisma on Ben Bradley. If you take Robards squared, you begin to approach the aura of Bradley. I was his lowly intern a couple of summers, and my desk was fairly near Ben Bradley's office. And I just watched him, and, you know, there he would march by about 9 feet tall. And
but seemed that way.
It sure seemed that way. I think that he was remarkable in a couple of ways. He really pushed the Post and journalism in new directions. He started the style section in the Washington Post, which was a huge innovation and really was just a great thing for the way it pushed journalism toward deal with issues that maybe hadn't broken yesterday but were important. Mm-hmm. And the other was that he was just extraordinary in the way he kind of galvanized the Wash Post and was a cheerleader for everybody. He brought out the best in that newsroom in a way that is, you know, I've seen very few managers who have that extraordinary ability to double the output of their staff.
And then just that willingness to bring out the big guns, take on the big guns with Pentagon Papers, with Watergate. Here he was in 2001 talking with on CNN's Capital Gang, saying the Pentagon Papers helped the Post make that leap as a newspaper.
The Post was still looking for a seat at the big table. We weren't at the big table yet, and we very much wanted to go there.
David Folkenflik, what is it about this man that allowed him to do this? I mean, this sort of pole vault for the Post, this big push for American journalism, the outsized ambition, the huge results. Here's a Boston Brahmin with his famous flair. Was it that visceral charisma? Was it some innate audacity, his view of what journalism should be? How do you see it, David?
I think you can tote up all of the above. You're talking about a guy, maybe he was aided in some funny way by a lack of introspection. He had a great sense of exactly who he was, of what he liked in journalists, of what he liked in their work. He inspired those who were like-minded to try to embody his values. He, and this is often forgotten, but in his early years, he really, really winnowed out the ranks and staff of the Post of people he thought didn't share his sense of metabolism, his desire, mm-hmm. his ambition for the paper. You know, he mentioned the Pentagon Papers. We lionize him, I think, rightly for his role in Watergate and the courage that he and Katharine Graham, his partners, along with the then unknown, you know, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, the courage that those folks displayed in taking on the Nixon administration and going ever closer, tightening the circle around the presidency itself. But the Pentagon Papers really was a moment. The New York Times had been enjoined from publishing these leaked documents with the secret history of the Vietnam War, you know, which still at that time was causing protests around the country in many ways and tumult throughout society. And the Washington Post said, fine, we will stand by our competitor, the New York Times. We're not going to shrink from their fight. We're going to say we stand shoulder to shoulder, which did two things. It meant that it elevated this to not just a fight between the Nixon administration and the New York Times, but a fight between the Nixon administration and the press writ large. Mm-hmm. And it also said to the world, the Washington Post is in some sense the equal of the New York Times. And I think the staff itself took that and never looked back.
Nick Kristoff, here's my question. A lot of that had to do with just plain brass. I mean, he had brass. And he brought it to American journalism. It brought in a generation, maybe you, certainly me, maybe David. Is it still out there? Is it still flowing in the veins of American journalism when the business models change, when so many publications are having so much trouble? Is the Bradley juice still there, Nick, in your view?
You know, whenever I go speak at universities, I ask people, I ask professors about the kids going into journalism school. And boy, it's an uncertain time. We don't know what the business model is going to be like 10 or 20 years from now. And my sense is there has been perhaps a modest drop in the competition to study journalism now or to aspire to a career in journalism, but only a modest drop. And it is still remarkable how many incredibly talented young people there are in this country and abroad who dream of having an impact through the articles, through their YouTube clips, through social media, through all the incredible platforms that that people have today. And so I think that still that juice and charisma, the excitement of the news media, I think to a considerable degree that survives.
But David, what about the ambition not just to get into it, but to take the tool once you've picked it up and use it big, to break the big story, to take on the big power? Is it there? Does it thrive in this new media environment?
Well, you see, the spirit you're describing is a bit of the rebellious spirit that perhaps was in some ways best embodied by Carl Bernstein of the mm-hmm. two of those guys. Mm-hmm. You see that in places like Mother Jones. You see that in places like Vice News. You see that in, some of the less conventional reporting that you might see on news sites. You see that in some ways, I think in many ways a harmful and intellectually dishonest ways in James O'Keefe, who I think sort of is an activist more than a journalist but portrays himself as a citizen journalist. It exists. What you do see is I think we're helped a bit by the amnesia here of young journalists today who haven't lived through the cutbacks and are forging their own path. And I'm hopeful that a lot of them will realize their own ambitions perhaps on new platforms and in ways unimagined by Woodward and Bernstein.
Pick up that torch. Take it right on. Ben Bradley, gone at 93. David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. It's always great to talk with you, David. Thanks for joining us from New York today.
You bet.
And Nicholas Kristof, co-author of A Path Appears. Nick, wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.